From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. ABC News correspondent John Miller is one of the few Western journalists who have interviewed Osama bin Laden. His 1998 interview was broadcast on Nightline. Miller has been reporting on terrorism for 10 years. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about his interview with bin Laden and his new book, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot, and why the FBI and CIA failed to stop it. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 13-CD compilation of recordings by pianist Maurizio Pollini. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Justice Department is asking a federal judge to freeze some of the assets of Andrew Fastow, former chief financial officer at Enron. Meanwhile, Fastow's top lieutenant pleaded guilty today to conspiracy to commit wire fraud and money laundering. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Michael Copper, former managing director of Enron Global Finance, has agreed to turn over $12 million in illegal profits to a fund to reimburse Enron victims. He also agreed to provide information about the case to prosecutors, according to Deputy U.S. Attorney General Larry Thompson.
This plea marks a significant milestone in the Enron investigation. We have secured the cooperation of an important witness.
During his courtroom appearance in Houston, Copper said he and Fastow had used Enron's off-the-books partnerships to siphon money to themselves and their friends. And in a statement read later by his attorney, Copper apologized to those hurt in the scandal. Copper will be sentenced next April and faces a maximum of 15 years in prison. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
President Bush said today that he'll consult with allies before taking any military action against Iraq. He told reporters at his Texas ranch that his administration believes Saddam Hussein is a threat, and he said that a regime change in Iraq would be in the best interest of the world. But the president said the issue of military action against Iraq didn't come up during a meeting with his top military advisors. Meanwhile, Tom DeLay, the number three Republican in the House of Representatives, says the U.S. must attack Iraq, and soon. DeLay was speaking today in Houston, Texas. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports.
DeLay's remarks constitute a ringing endorsement of President Bush's policy of regime change in Iraq. DeLay says the U.S. is no longer just a superpower, but a super-duper power, and therefore must take the lead in overthrowing Iraqi President Saddam Hussein.
Until Saddam Hussein's regime topples, our national security will suffer an unwise and an unacceptable risk. Saddam must go, and the sooner the better.
DeLay's speech comes at a time of growing debate over the wisdom of military action against Iraq. The U.S.'s allies in Europe and the Middle East, as well as a number of prominent Republicans at home, have spoken out against a preemptive attack. DeLay dismisses opponents of a war as appeasers and apologists for idleness. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News.
Pakistan's president has changed his country's constitution to extend his term in office and give himself broad new powers. General Pervez Musharraf said the amendments are designed to guide Pakistan to an elected democracy. The changes grant the president the authority to dissolve parliament and formalize a 5-year extension to his term. In stocks, the Dow gained 85 points today and the Nasdaq gained 32. This is NPR News. A federal judge in Buffalo, New York, refused today to accept a plea bargain offered by a man and woman charged with helping an anti-abortion radical who's accused of murdering a doctor. The judge said that Dennis Malvasi and Loretta Mara must face trial next month. The New York City couple had offered to plead guilty in helping accused sniper James Kopp in exchange for prison terms of no more than 33 months. If they're convicted at trial, the couple could face as much as 10 years in jail. James Kopp is accused of killing Dr. Barnett Slepian, an obstetrician who performed abortions. A San Diego jury has convicted a neighbor in the kidnapping and murder of 7-year-old Danielle Van Dam. Eric Anderson has more from member station KPBS in San Diego.
The panel of 6 men and 6 women deliberated for just over 9 days before coming back with guilty verdicts on all charges. David Westerfield was convicted of murder in the first degree, kidnapping, and possession of child pornography. San Diego Police Chief David Bejarano says he's pleased with the decision.
Obviously, we're very satisfied, and we were dedicated and committed to finding the person responsible for the kidnapping and murder of Danielle.
The 7-year-old girl was snatched from her home at the beginning of February and was found dead nearly a month later. The girl's blood was found in one of Westerfield's jackets, and her hair was found inside his motorhome. For NPR News, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
Canada's prime minister announced today that he won't seek a fourth term in office. Jean Chrétien told reporters that he plans to leave office in February of 2004. The 68-year-old prime minister faced a strong challenge within his own Liberal Party. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novozoy Brandeis O'Flavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Miller, is one of the few Western journalists who have interviewed Osama bin Laden. He's been reporting on terrorism for the past 10 years and is the co-author of the new book, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot and Why the FBI and CIA Failed to Stop It. Miller is an ABC News correspondent and co-host of 2020. His 1998 interview with bin Laden was broadcast on ABC's Evening News and on Nightline. That interview was also videotaped by bin Laden's cameraman. And that tape is one of the al-Qaeda videos that CNN just acquired. I asked Miller if there were guidelines that he was given by al-Qaeda for his interview with bin Laden.
Well, it was a very odd set of ground rules. They weren't really worked out in advance as much as they were worked out on the spot. We were asked to submit the questions in writing, which is something we normally do not do, but they said that it would be necessary for their translator to be able to copy the questions over into Arabic so that as I asked them, he could translate them exactly in real time correctly. But they also said we could pretty much ask anything we wanted. So we gave them a list of about 20 questions. And when we got to the site of the interview a couple of days later, they said that Mr. bin Laden would answer all the questions, but that they would not translate his answers. I objected, saying that makes it very difficult to ask follow-up questions, and they said, that's no problem. There will be no follow-up questions. So the ground rules were a little odd.
Well, it must have been bizarre for you to interview somebody and have no idea what he was saying in response to your questions.
Well, made more bizarre by the fact that bin Laden had the trace of a smile. He had what appeared to be very kind and understanding eyes. So here's this fella looking at you with a bit of a smile, looking at you right in the eye, and he's speaking this almost high-pitched, soft voice. And if you had to guess what he was saying, it would have been like getting advice from a sweet old uncle. Later, when it was translated, and we learned that he was saying that he was declaring war on America, that he would send Americans back in coffins and boxes, and that the war would start soon, it was very disconcerting, considering what it looked and sounded like. The other odd thing was, to keep him focused on me and not the translator, who he kept looking at with the perfect knowledge that I didn't understand what he was saying, I kept giving him eye contact and nodding up and down. So, of course, when the translation runs, it looks like I'm nodding almost in agreement. It was, like I said, it was not your normal interview.
That's right. Because he's saying things like, we are sure of our victory. Our battle with the Americans is larger than our battle with the Russians. We predict a black day for America and the end of the United States. And you're nodding in agreement, it looks like.
Although, I have to say, if you look back, if you looked at those words at the time, and we all did, we thought it was pretty hyperbolic.
Yeah,
who's this,
sure.
Who's this guy? What's he going to do? You know, declaring war on the United States from his little camp. If you look back at it in the post-September 11th reality, the words have a very different resonance.
What do you think are the most important things bin Laden told you in your interview with him?
Well, I think the context of the interview itself was important, meaning this just wasn't a personality profile and a guy named bin Laden who might have been a bad guy. We were allowed to locate him. We started this. He didn't. He didn't call up and invite us to do this interview. We were trying to connect with him for months. I think the reason he allowed us to find him was because this was essentially his coming out party as a terrorist leader. He had been on the CIA's radar screen and the FBI's for a while, but he hadn't introduced himself to the American public, really, not in that kind of forum. So I think he had things to say, and he wanted them to reach the American public before he organized and had carried out the embassy bombings, which were scheduled for 6 weeks after the interview. He wanted to put a stamp on it in advance. The most important things he said, he framed his issues at the time, which were U.S. military to leave its bases in Saudi Arabia. He felt they were desecrating holy ground. For the U.S. to end its support of Israel in consideration of the Palestinian issue, and to end the bombing of Iraq.
Now, one of the main points in your book, The Cell, is that United States intelligence failed to follow up on a lot of the clues that could have prevented September 11th. Were there clues, do you think, of what was to come that Bin Laden gave you in the interview he did with you in 1998?
Well, Bin Laden always leaves hidden messages, at least that's my feeling, when he does an interview like that. If you read that interview now and say that he had said that a week before September 11th, or even a week after, it would have made perfect sense. He said it in 1998, but there's a pattern there, meaning he did that 6 weeks before the embassy bombings, just before the explosion of the USS Cole, the attack by a boat bomb sent by Bin Laden. He held a he released a videotape of him and his leaders saying that there was too much talking, and not enough action. The time had come for action, and he was dressed in Yemeni traditional garb with a Yemeni dagger sticking out of his belt. Nobody made much of that at the time. Of course, after the Cole was bombed in Yemen, people looked back at that tape and they said, "Hey, you know, we may have missed a signal here." So he does leave subtle hints. I think if you look at his interview with ABC News in 1998, talking about declaring war on America, talking about issuing a fatwa that included not just people in military uniforms, to use his words, but this fatwa also applies to civilians too, I think he was telling us the ground rules, or at least what we believe the ground rules of the war on terrorism and its war against us were changing.
Do you think that Bin Laden is still alive?
I believe he's alive. That's not based on evidence per se, but I speak to sources every day who say they continue to get intelligence about sightings, not the kinds of sightings that that they're sure enough about, but the kind of sightings that still are hints of Bin Laden's presence. But I also look at it in an overall picture. He's worth $25 million, dead or alive, according to the President of the United States. And if he were dead and people in, let's say, Afghanistan knew about it, that's a country with a lot of people in a position to move around with weapons who would maybe want to come up with that body and collect that money, and no one's been able to do that.
One of the CNN tapes brought back from Afghanistan, and the tape that so far has gotten the most attention, is the one of a dog who is exposed to what appears to be a chemical weapon, and the dog loses muscular control, chokes, and apparently dies. What does that lead you to speculate about Bin Laden's, Al-Qaeda's capability with chemical weapons?
Well, I mean, there's no real secret about Bin Laden's intent there. We asked him, and he told us in the interviews that he felt it was his duty to obtain chemical and biological, even nuclear weapons, to obtain them and use them as he saw fit. After the fall of Kandahar, I've been told by sources in the intelligence community that Bin Laden's chemical weapons laboratory was discovered just a few miles east of the Kandahar airport. I've reviewed some of the evidence that they say they collected there, which shows, you know, a real lab setup with beakers and test tubes and chemicals. Of course, it was hit by U.S. bombs and destroyed. But the fact that there is this video of that experiment, of them actually apparently what it appears to be is testing a chemical weapon like sarin gas or VX gas that apparently was either obtained by them or made by them, shows they were a couple of steps closer in their program to having something that they could use. And that's a little worrisome.
A little?
A lot worrisome when you consider it in the context of they adjust with these attacks. I'm not talking about Bin Laden as much as all terrorists, but the pattern is They launch one kind of attack, whether it's airplane hijackings or truck bombs, and we tend to respond by hardening the targets. We put walls around the embassies that trucks can't penetrate. We increase airline security. They usually just switch to another kind of attack and target a softer target. So, of course, you want to conceptualize what would happen if the material that killed that dog was poured out onto the floor in the middle of a busy mall in anywhere USA. People would start to go down. Someone would call the police. Police, ambulance, fire people would respond. They would start to go down as well. It would take till the second or third wave of first responders to realize probably what was going on. And very much like the anthrax scares we've had here in the United States, including the incidents with real anthrax, there's not going to be 2,800 people killed in an incident like that from the World Trade Center, but the fear factor is going to be very high.
My guest is ABC News correspondent John Miller. He's the co-author of the new book, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is ABC News correspondent John Miller, who's also co-host of 2020. His new book is called The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot and Why the FBI and CIA Failed to Stop It. You have a lot in the new book about clues that the FBI and CIA didn't pick up on, clues that they could have followed and didn't. And one of the main stories that you follow in the book dates back to, I think it's 1990, the assassination of the far-right Israeli leader Meir Kahane, who actually grew up in New York, where he founded the Jewish Defense League, a far-right group. The assassin was El-Sayed Nasser. What are some of the clues that the assassination of Meir Kahane could have provided to future attacks on the United States?
Well, it's the clues that it did provide that were somewhat overlooked, especially early on. El-Sayed Nasser shoots Meir Kahane that night in the Marriott Hotel in Manhattan. That night, police from New York City go to his house, and they detain two men as possible accomplices because they readily admit to having been in the area of the hotel at the time of the murder. They're ordered by the police brass to cut these guys loose right away with no further investigation. They really were anxious at that time to get on to the press and say, we have a murder, we have a gunman, the case is solved, there's no reason to be afraid. Those two men later ended up being two of the World Trade Center bombers in 1993, so they weren't looked at closely enough at the time. They also took 16 boxes out of El-Sayed Nasser's house in New Jersey, which contained diagrams of how to make and dismantle bombs, confidential documents from the U.S. Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, things that were training exercises for the U.S. military, diagrams of New York landmarks, writings in Arabic that weren't translated for years that included discussion of plans to topple America's tallest buildings, things that have a lot more resonance now than they did then. But after the World Trade Center bombing was committed and investigators learned that the men around that plot were essentially the followers of Nasser, they really had to take a look back and say, should we have looked at this stuff harder a long time ago?
Why didn't they? Why didn't the FBI follow up on investigating Nasser's collaborators?
Well, I think that involves more law enforcement's dirty little secret, which is they're very competitive. You know, every press conference at every major bust starts off with, you know, how closely all the agencies work together. The fact is, I worked in law enforcement long enough to get an inside view of that, and they're very competitive. They're often trying to undercut each other. After the Kahane murder, there was a fight between the FBI and the U.S. attorney and the NYPD and the local district attorney over who would really handle the case. Ultimately, the district attorney in New York City said this is a local murder and it's my case. So the FBI had taken all of the evidence found at Nocera's house from the police, and then the district attorney demanded it back. And while it went from the police office to the FBI office to the district attorney's office, after they were done fighting over who would get the case, no one really went through the boxes and analyzed what was in it until after the World Trade Center bombing. Then they found it was filled with a lot of clues.
Right. Now, you described Nocera, the assassin of Kahani, as becoming a star of the new jihad movement in the United States.
They refer to him as the godfather of jihad among the detectives on the terrorist task force and the agents because he was the first one to take direct action for an Islamic terrorism cell in the United States. And when he was caught and sentenced to prison in the meetings in Attica, he urged the others to take action, saying, listen, I'm here in jail. Now someone else has to step up to the plate. The plots discussed were plots to break him out of prison, plots to assassinate not just Jewish leaders and politicians in New York City, but politicians like Alphonse D'Amato, who just supported Israel. There was a hit list, and then a plot to blow up 12 Jewish locations in New York City, which ended up developing into a plot not to blow up 12 locations, but to place one big bomb in one location, the World Trade Center.
Did any of the terrorists involved with the September 11th attacks have any affiliation with Nocera?
No, it was a generation of terrorists later by the fact that Nocera's cell was broken down after the first World Trade Center bombing. Then the terrorist task force broke up the plot among Nocera's other followers to blow up the bridges and tunnels, the UN and the FBI building in New York. So that group was pretty much taken off the map. But by then, the signs were there that there was a larger force here. Nocera's followers were also followers of the Blind Sheikh, as he's known today, Omar Abdel Rahman, who was preaching at a mosque in Brooklyn at the time and calling for his followers to act out jihad against the United States, holy war. So that that group was taken out. But what they learned was Nocera's defense fund was funded by Osama bin Laden to the tune of $20,000. Some of that money was allegedly diverted to finance the World Trade Center bombing, that the Blind Sheikh's living expenses were being paid for month to month by bin Laden, that the refugee center located in his mosque was being paid for by bin Laden and affiliated with the other Afghan services office and refugee center in Peshawar, Pakistan, which was the organization that eventually turned into Al-Qaeda.
In looking at some of the history that led up to September 11th, what do you think is one of the biggest missed opportunities that intelligence didn't follow up on?
If I had to pick one, and I wouldn't pick one, I'd say it was a combination, but if I had to focus on a single one that was probably the most serious miss, it would be the CIA was tasked at the point that they were sure an attack was brewing somewhere in the world, maybe even in the United States, to try and pull out all the stops. They went over everything they had, and they came up with a meeting of Al-Qaeda terrorists in Malaysia that was videotaped. They brought photographs of that meeting to the FBI's terrorist task force in New York, and they laid the photographs out, and they said to the agents and detectives, "What can you tell us about these guys?" And then instead of putting their cards on the table and sharing what they had, after the detectives and agents said, well, we can identify this one or that one, we think some of them were involved in the coal bombing, when the detectives and agents said, what can you tell us? The CIA essentially told them, well, you're not cleared for that information. The meeting degenerated into a shouting match and ultimately broke up. That was on June 11th. I think had everybody put their heads together and compared notes, they probably would have found out that two of the people at that meeting were Khalid al-Midhar, another one of the 19 hijackers, Mr. al-Hamzi, Nawaf al-Hamzi. Had they decided, well, let's see if these people are in the United States, yes, they had come into the United States under their real names. Could they have been located and put under surveillance? Had that happened, they would have been trailed to flight schools. They would have been seen meeting with the other hijackers. Their phones could have been bugged. Their emails could have been monitored. A lot of things could have been done that could have really put investigators onto the plot before it happened. None of that happened, and essentially it all boils down to interagency bickering and hoarding of information and not sharing the facts. And I think that's one of the things that has hurt the effort over the years.
Has there been any reform on interagency communication?
I think there's been a lot since September 11th. I think the message from the White House to the FBI and the CIA has been, hey, you guys get together on this, and let's not have anything else slip through the cracks because the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. I also think with a new FBI director, Mr. Mueller, in place, I think his relationship with George Tenet at the CIA is fairly fresh and open. And I certainly think because of what happened on September 11th, the actual sharing between agents at the FBI and officers at the CIA has probably broken through a lot of the barriers that would have been in place before that.
There was a Pentagon report, a Pentagon-funded report that was released in 1993 that referred to the possibility of terrorists using planes as bombs. The report's principal author, Marvin Citron, wrote that he can imagine coming down the Potomac, you could make a left turn at the Washington Monument and take out the White House, or you could make a right turn and take out the Pentagon. This report apparently was never released. Why wasn't it released?
Well, I spoke to Marvin about that an awful lot. And, of course, Marvin was Chicken Little. He was running around saying, the sky's falling, the sky's falling, after the Defense Department had contracted him to say, if the sky was going to fall, what could we do about it? And the answer was, we were very vulnerable. He wrote the report, and it was shown to the Defense Department and the State Department. And the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism reviewed it and said, A, the things in here probably are never going to happen. B, if we release this to the public, it's going to scare the heck out of everybody. And C, if we scare the heck out of everybody and there isn't a crisis, we're just going to get yelled at for frightening them. One person told Marvin, you can't manage a crisis until you have the crisis. So they put the report in a drawer, showed it around the government a little bit, shoved it in the back of a drawer, and it was never really seen till a newspaper reporter found it and started writing about its predictions. The thing is, they had hired Marvin to predict the future. And if you read that report, Marvin did his job, I'm sorry to say.
Who is he?
He is a really interesting character. He's a futurist. He is not a terrorism expert, although he has become one because of this. He is a guy who looks at trends in business and science and then tries to predict where they'll go and where we'll end up in 10 years or 20 years. He was simply tasked, after somebody read one of his other reports about the future of something else, to say, forecast the future of America's vulnerability to terrorism. And he did that. The bad news is, a lot of his forecasts came true.
John Mueller is an ABC News correspondent and co-host of 2020. He's the co-author of the new book, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot and Why the FBI and CIA Failed to Stop It. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the state of Vermont, linking midweek travelers with the annual Fall Colors of Vermont. Online travel planner at vermontvacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 13-CD compilation of recordings by pianist Maurizio Pollini. And we continue our talk about terrorism with ABC News correspondent John Mueller, co-author of The Cell.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with John Miller, ABC News correspondent and co-host of 2020. He's been covering terrorism for 10 years and interviewed Osama bin Laden in 1998. Miller is the co-author of the new book, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot and Why the FBI and CIA Failed to Stop It. I asked him about one of the leaders of the plot, Muhammad Atta. Now, it seems that Muhammad Atta's original plan was to use crop dusters. And
Muhammad Atta walked into a U.S. government farm loan office and tried to get a U.S. government loan to buy a crop duster, which would have been a terrible irony that the government could have actually financed this plot as well as having been one of the primary victims of it. And it seemed that Atta's interest in crop dusters seemed to revolve around what their containment was, what their ability to carry crop dusting chemicals were, how many gallons, what's the disbursement rate. A lot of people took that as a signal that they must have been planning a chemical weapons attack to spray some city with anthrax or sarin gas. But it's much more likely, based on the analysis of investigators I've spoken to at this point, that Atta was trying to find a plane that had a large enough storage compartment for explosives, a plane like a crop duster, that they could get a couple of and fly into the Pentagon or the White House or the Capitol or the World Trade Center that would have a big explosive charge. As it was, failing to obtain either the money to buy the crop dusters or the ability to obtain one of those planes another way, it appears that the plan just had to develop. It had to change. And the only way to get a big plane with explosive capability for free was to buy a ticket on one and take it.
So you could argue that when his plan to use crop dusters was foiled, he had to come up with an even more ambitious plan.
That's correct. And while it was more ambitious, it also, unlike the crop duster plan, which was a little complicated as well as ambitious, this plan was diabolically ingenious in its simplicity. To take on the government and economic structure of a superpower, to injure its economy, to carry out the largest terrorist attack in world history, to commit nearly 3,000 homicides. All it took was not a nuclear device or a dirty bomb or chemical or biological weapons. It was plane tickets and box cutters and a very good plan.
How far up within the al-Qaeda leadership do you think there was knowledge of the actual September 11th plan? I mean, do you think bin Laden knew the specifics of the plan? Do you think his aides knew the specifics of the plan? Or do you think they just knew that something big was going to happen and their guys were taking care of it?
Yes and no. Yes, I think bin Laden knew the plan, had approved the plan, signed off on the plan, had intimate knowledge of what the attack would be. That's actually borne out by videotapes that were recovered after the invasion of Afghanistan, where bin Laden is seen meeting with a supporter from Saudi Arabia where he tells him what he knew in advance. The other thing that tape revealed is the no part, that one or two of bin Laden's closest aides, I would guess Zawahiri and Atef, probably knew the same details of the plan, the date, the time, and the place. But other aides who were in on this discussion, proffered to this this sheikh who was visiting from Saudi Arabia, that when they heard the news, they were with bin Laden, and that it came as a big surprise to them, that they hadn't been in on the plot. So what the military calls operational security, keeping things close to the vest on a need-to-know-only basis, seemed to be maintained very well by al-Qaeda. Bin Laden and his two or three top people may have known. Certainly the operators of the cell knew, Muhammad Atta and his gang, although even they didn't know what their mission and their targets were until the day of the actual attack, probably beyond Atta and a couple of others.
Now, on September 9th of 2001, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld threatened to urge a veto if the Senate proceeded with its plan to divert $600 million from missile defense to counterterrorism. The Bush administration was really pushing missile defense then. Has Rumsfeld said anything after September 11th about how he feels about that statement now, and if he thinks it was still legitimate to try to use the money for missile defense as opposed to counterterrorism?
You know, I haven't heard him say anything about that, nor have I really heard much discussion from the Attorney General about turning down an FBI request for $56 million to revamp and increase their counterterrorism section before September 11th also. Of course, you know, they've done that threefold since then, but there was a pre-September 11th reality and there's a post-September 11th reality. The pre-September 11th reality was Tom Picard, the acting director of the FBI, walked into the Attorney General's office, and counterterrorism was at the top of his list. But he told me he couldn't get in to see the Attorney General for a long time about counterterrorism because the Attorney General's message was clear, just as Rumsfeld's message was clear about missile defense. His main issues were guns, drugs, and civil rights. And I would suggest that in his presentation to Congress, his main issues were guns and drugs until they asked him an awful lot of questions about racial profiling, and then civil rights was added to the agenda. But terrorism was nowhere the focus. When the Bush administration came in, there were two submarines parked in position to launch missiles against bin Laden's camp that had been there for months in the Clinton administration. They were pulled out. Just the focus was very different.
The last line of your book, The Cell, is a very creepy last line. It says, the next wave of attacks, if they are not prevented, could make September 11th a pale and distant memory. What are some of the things you're thinking of there?
Well, if you look at some of the things that have just come up in the past few days, that bin Laden is possessed and it was experimenting with chemical weapons, some of the other plots that they've talked about, including everything from flying planes into buildings to driving a large truck bomb into Herald Square in New York City in front of a department store, or to Century City in Los Angeles, or into the middle of the financial district in New York, or a busy place in Chicago. If you did that once, you could cause terror. If you had cells operating in the United States, as the U.S. government believes they do, and you did that five times in one day or even one week, you could cause massive terror. I think the one thing we learned from September 11th is almost no matter how much terror you cause here, it is very hard to cause panic. Even through such an attack, New York City and the federal government held themselves together and acted very responsibly and very responsively.
My guest is ABC News correspondent John Miller. He's the co-author of the new book, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is ABC News correspondent John Miller, and he's also a co-host of 2020. His new book is called The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot and Why the FBI and CIA Failed to Stop It. I've got a more personal question for you. I read in a biography that your father was a reporter for the National Enquirer, for the tabloid, and I had to wonder, what kind of stories did he write?
Well, he wrote, he was a real character. And he wrote seven different columns in the Enquirer under six different names. So he was John J. Miller in the column that had his best items. He was John Rellum, which was Miller spelled backwards, in the column that got his second string items. He was Sergio someone from Rome and Nigel someone from London and Pierre someone from Paris. And he was somebody from L.A. And he would sit in an office with five telephone lines ringing and a secretary juggling the calls. And he would kind of take rat-a-tat items from waiters and showgirls and maitre d's and press agents and stick them all on the spike that went to the different column that they were intended for. And, you know, ran a small kind of cheesy tabloid empire from a little office. It was interesting to watch as a kid. Was more interesting to go with him on his rounds, though.
Why was that so interesting?
Well, because I was 7, 8, 9 years old, and he would take me out in the city at night, and the police radio would be crackling in the car, and he would take me to the Copa and to the El Morocco, and you would see a show with Shecky Green as the comic, followed by Dean Martin as the main act, and you'd end up in the lounge surrounded by a bunch of guys named Tough Tony and Angelo Two Times and, you know, guys banging their pinky rings on the table and smoking cigars, and then you'd end up at a crime scene, and you'd get home way past your bedtime and try and tell this to the kids in the second grade the next day. It was an entertaining way to grow up. Taught me a part about New York City that most people wouldn't learn for years to come. By the time I would have learned it, it was gone.
Writing for the National Enquirer, did your father, when he came home from work, tell you, don't believe everything you read, son?
He told me the opposite. He said, this paper is sued so much that if we print it, the lawyers have been over it 15 times. It's got to be true. Of course, I always questioned that when they said, you know, the two-headed alien baby headline was on the front page.
Yeah, so what
but
did he tell
again,
you about
how many,
that?
How many two-headed alien babies really had lawyers who could sue? I mean, it was a very interesting time because when the Enquirer came out, it wasn't the National Enquirer, it was the New York Enquirer. It was a local weekly here, and the owner had decided he could find a niche in the market for a different kind of newspaper. The other papers combined to keep it off the stands because there were seven dailies at the time and nobody wanted an eighth paper to compete with. So the owner of the paper, Gene Pope, went to a business consultant and said, I can't sell my paper on the newsstands and I don't know where else to sell a newspaper. And the guy thought about it for a while and said, listen, you ever been standing in the supermarket at that checkout line where there's nothing to do and nothing to see? Why don't you put your paper there? And thus was born the supermarket tabloid.
What was it like for you when you started working in journalism yourself and you were exposed to all the ethics of journalism that you had to learn and abide by? After growing up in this kind of anything-goes type of environment with a father who worked at the National Enquirer.
Well, it sounds like Bert Kearns' book, Tabloid Baby, right? I guess I was literally the tabloid baby. First of all, my father was a pretty good reporter. He taught me the ethics of journalism, and he taught me a lot of the tricks of the trade also. But when I went to work in the Channel 5 newsroom, I was 14 years old. I was in the ninth grade. I'd been trained on the street by my dad. And I ended up working on the desk with Ted Kavanaugh and Mark Monsky, some really brilliant people there who taught me the real rules of journalism, which was how to get it fast, how to get it right, how to keep it fair. There was a big sign over the door at Channel 5 News. When you walked out to go on your story, it said, there are two sides to every story. How many did you get? And I remember I came back years later and the sign had changed. It now said, do you have your beeper? Is it on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, that was, I'm not going to make a conclusion there. It's just that the shifting priorities in television journalism had posted themselves in my mind.
Right. No, another question for you. In 1994, you briefly gave up journalism to join the New York City Police Department as Deputy Commissioner for Public Information. What was it like to see law enforcement from inside the operation as opposed to investigating it as a journalist?
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, like anybody who's had their nose pressed up against the same piece of glass long enough, you want to know, what's it really like on the other side? And I remember trading in a fairly good television salary and a lifestyle to go to work essentially as a civil servant. And I showed up the first day and I thought, well, at least now I'll have the access. Because frankly, the police department is the last exclusive club on earth. You know, when you flash your badge at the scene of the crime and you cross that yellow tape, there are very few people allowed on the other side of that, whether they have money or power or friends. That's a pretty private zone. And to be on the other side of the tape was fascinating, but I have to say, in the first week, we had some crisis developed. And I remember walking past all the cameras, flashbulbs popping, people yelling questions and thinking, just a week ago, I would have been on the other side of that tape, and I would have been the one with the questions. I'm going to go in behind this door, and it's going to close. And I'm going to be on the other side, and I'm going to be the one learning the answers. And I remember the door closed, and John Timoney, our chief, was there, and he said, let's get one thing straight. Those fellas on the outside already know about more about this case than we do, and if we don't spin it right, we're dead. And I thought, maybe I made a might have made a really big mistake here. The other thing it taught me was we had a shooting, and we were having trouble getting the details from the cops about how it had come to pass that they had shot this fella. And it had been hours, and we were about to do a press conference and didn't have enough answers. And I said to Timoney, well, it's been hours. Why haven't they been able to tell us their story? And he said, Johnny boy, you'll learn when there's trouble getting the information, it's usually because there's trouble with the information. In many ways, the experience made me a better reporter when I left.
How?
I realized two important things. One, that so many times when I had 9 out of 10 pieces of the story, and I called some public official and said, is this true? And they waved me off. I was probably right, because I had many reporters call me, and they'd say they would kind of lay out the whole story before me, and it was something that was either confidential or that we didn't want out, and I would say, I can't comment on it, and hang up the phone. And oftentimes they went with it, and sometimes they didn't, but it was always remarkable to me how oftentimes they had it all and just didn't know if they had it all. The other thing it taught me was what it's like on the other side. I mean, I think in the context of this book, what it's like on the other side, because as a reporter, you're always covering the police saying, look at what they've done wrong. Look at the scandal. Look at the corruption. Look at the mistakes. As a police official, I remember showing up to work every day and saying, every day, 40,000 people come to these buildings and precincts and police cars and set out to try and do the right thing. And every day, it seems like we're under assault from the press, from every direction, for any little thing they can find. If you look at the 9/11 plot, there were so many detectives and investigators and FBI agents and CIA officers who had been doing the right things for years. And, of course, the focus is are all on the missteps and the mistakes. And that's, of course, because the cost was so great. But it almost sounds like you write them off as being the Keystone Cops when most of the time they do pretty well.
Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry, and thanks for having me on, and thanks for giving me so much time.
John Miller is a correspondent for ABC News and co-host of 2020. He's the co-author of the new book, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot and Why the FBI and CIA Failed to Stop It. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 13-CD box set of recordings by pianist Maurizio Pollini. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Maurizio Pollini has been playing in public for more than 40 years. Now there's a 13-CD compilation of his recordings called the Maurizio Pollini Edition. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz considers Pollini one of the great musicians of our time.
There's a bonus disc in the new 13-CD anthology of recordings by Maurizio Pollini
that includes a live performance of Chopin's first piano concerto, made during the 1960 Chopin competition in Warsaw, when Pellini was only 18. Here's a passage from the lovely slow movement, Romance. You can already hear the miraculous Pellini qualities, the extraordinary sweetness of the sound, and the uncanny definition of every note, no matter how fast it's going by. There's a brilliant gleam, some critics have called cold, but which to his admirers seems like controlled white heat. And the shapeliness of the phrasing, like singing, a sense of both moment and movement, that everything is connected, coming from somewhere and heading somewhere. The whole set brings home the great range of Pellini's musical interests. Although there's no Bach or any Baroque music at all, the earliest composer represented is Mozart, Pellini presents a direct line from Mozart and Beethoven to Schumann, Schubert, Brahms, remarkably unmelodramatic Liszt, brilliant yet unshowy Chopin, and scintillating, witty Debussy. Then zoom, we're in the 20th century, with ravishing performances of the major modern masters, Schoenberg, Webern, Stravinsky, and Bartok, and of the most radical music of the next generation. One piece by Luigi Nono, called Like a Wave of Strength and Light, has some of the most elegant pounding on record. Pellini was only the second major pianist to record the complete solo piano music of Schoenberg. Glenn Gould beat him by a decade. And it's startling how different they are. Here's the last movement waltz from Schoenberg's five piano pieces, Opus 23, his very first full use of the 12-tone system. Pellini plays it as a real waltz in the tradition of Brahms and all the Strausses. It's flowing, gemütlich, lilting. Yet its harmonies are also something new in the world. Pellini lets us hear the continuity not only within this short piece, but also with its history, the past out of which it has emerged. Compared to Pellini's version, Gould's 1965 recording sounds as if it comes from a different century, a newer century. Disjunctive, angular, teasing, Gould's Schoenberg is nothing if not modern. We can hear the shadowy waltz in the distance, but this isn't music you could dance to. Pollini's version may not be quite as much fun as Gould's, as crackling, but it's more knowing, insinuating, more European, and more beautiful. Pollini isn't always on. I'm a little disappointed with the two late Beethoven sonatas. The sheer facility of Pollini's playing seems to undercut the very struggle with form and articulation Beethoven seems to be grappling with. I've heard concerts at which it has taken him the entire first half to warm up, to get over his shyness. What a peculiar genius. There's no major musician today who can be more frustrating or more profoundly satisfying.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Pollini collection on Deutsche Grammophon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schirach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Lindley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, screenwriter and actor Mike White. He wrote the new film The Good Girl, starring Jennifer Aniston, and he wrote and starred in the independent film Chuck and Buck. Also, actress Cynthia Nixon, one of the stars of Sex and the City. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.